What happens when two Bass Road Warriors spend quality time talking music and life with one of their peers? Find out every Monday at 8 on Notes from an Artist. Bassist, educator, author David C. Gross, and bassist and head honcho of KnowYourBassPlayer.com, Tom Semioli, trade eights with the legends of rock, jazz, funk, blues, folk, country, and more. Notes from an Artist, revealing conversations with the legends who've created the soundtrack of our lives. Every Monday at 8 on CygnusRadio.com. And check out previous episodes on our podcast. NotesFromAnArtist.Buzzsprout.com.
So, Annie Haslam, what can I say? She is amazing. What an upbeat spirit. What a great storyteller. Oh, my God, you're going to hear some wonderful stories in this interview. And Tom, she was in Renaissance.
She was a teenage crush for many an American male in the 1970s, myself included. Interesting how she describes Renaissance not as prog rock, but orchestral rock. And they were certainly in the mix with Genesis, Jethro Tull, Gentle Giant, Yes, King Crimson, the Straubs. And for some reason, and she goes into this, they were particularly popular on the East Coast of the United States. That's where they had their greatest success.
If you think about it, if you're coming from England, where do you stop first?
New York.
So New York was Genesis land. Gentle Giant, you mentioned them earlier, was a great band, but they were pretty well unknown throughout America, except to that prog rock crowd. And you just think of Crimson. All those bands were really big here. And I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that it was close proximity, almost the same as all the records went to Liverpool. All the R&B and stuff started there. I think there was some sort of symbiotic relationship there.
Right. And Renaissance, of course, started by former Yardbirds, Keith Ralph and Jim McCarty. She discusses also being engaged to Roy Wood, which was the funniest few years of her life. She talks about her friendship with Sandy Denny and also reveals a hysterical story with Eric Idle trying to free Paul McCartney when Paul was arrested in Japan in 1980.
Yeah, guys, you're going to love this. This is a wonderful story. We've got a lot of great music in it, and that's enough. So why don't we just start the interview. Hi, Annie.
All right. There you are, Annie. How you doing? David, I see you. Boy, David, you're usually on top. How did I get on the top of the screen here?
No, you're to my right or to my left, as the case may be.
Where do I know the name David Cross from?
David, who does she know you from?
I don't know. I'm a bass player.
Oh, that's probably what.
Yeah. We're both bass players.
And I'll tell you something else, Annie.
David plays
really
more notes than I do.
It's a good name for a bass player.
But Annie, you know what's really interesting? My sister was good friends with Jim McCarty in the 60s.
Oh, what a spirit he is. He's a bit naughty, though. But we are all as British are, of course. Rick Wakeman being the worst.
Yes, yes. He gives great Hall of Fame speeches. I love it.
My ex-wife, her sister was married to Ian McDonald. So I've been stuck with you Brits forever.
Of course, I know Ian as well.
Yeah, of course.
How is he doing?
Last I heard, he's doing very, very well.
Good. Yeah, he's always at the Cutting Room in New York City. That's his hangout. So if you need to find
him, he's a butcher.
I've got new friends down at the Cutting Room. Yeah, Steve Walters is a huge Renaissance fan. And yeah, I opened up. No, I didn't open up. What am I talking about? I was a guest with my friend Jan Close, who's a singer-songwriter. I don't know if you know him. He's pretty brilliant. And that was just before the pandemic. Though, of course.
David, tell Annie about our pod performance at Cutting Room, which we're planning on.
Well, yeah, we had a meeting with Steve about, I guess it's almost 4 weeks ago. Basically, we actually thought that Comrade de Blasio would have opened up a little bit better than he has. We were going to do something called Podformances, which is where we would do what we're doing now, but in person, live, and the artists that we were working with would go and perform. So we had Ron Carter was going to be our first one, which would have been very, very easy because all he'd had to do was bring a bass.
Right.
And so we're hopeful that that's going to transpire. It's just we have to wait a little bit and see exactly how the city deals with the vaxxers and the non-vaxxers and the this and the that.
I've got a Christmas show booked at the Sellersville. That's the only thing we have. We lost 2 years' work, which you probably, obviously realize. And we were going like all over the world, Brazil. I was going to Portugal with Patrick Moraes. We were doing a duo thing at a festival there. That's gone. And I don't think they've recovered from it because I don't think they're doing it again. But again, it's so many things that that limit musicians now in Europe, which is a visa situation, you know.
Right, right.
And, but I've got my Christmas show coming up in Sellersville. But I, you know, if there's any doubt that there's something, because I'm high risk because I had breast cancer, so my immune system's low. So I can't afford to take any chances of anything. I was going to see King Crimson a couple of days ago, and I didn't go because apart from the fact that I couldn't find anybody who'd go with me for the same reason that I ended up not going either, is because the number of people that were in the audience would have been amazingly huge. And also, I wouldn't have been able to get back to see my friend Gavin, you know, and Robert. So I didn't go. Yeah. I didn't go. It's a shame.
I love the Sellersville Theater. It's a great place to play.
Yeah, I've been doing my Christmas show there for like 8 years, 9 years now. But I didn't last year, of course.
Yeah, of course. Well, you're just a prog rocker. What can I tell you?
A symphonic rocker.
That's it.
Symphonic rocker. Thank you very much for...
A lot of ogs in there. But, well, let's go back.
Prog music, if you listen to real prog music, it's really quite heavy.
It is, yes.
And it's... Okay, I'm looking around here because I've got pets and I just turned my dishwasher off. It's very male. I mean, it's very male-oriented. It just didn't seem right to call us a prog band because we're not, because it's classical, you know... It's classical rock band we used to call ourselves in the 70s, but people kept putting this label on us, and then I thought, well, I'm going to change it to symphonic, and then if it catches on, it catches on. If it doesn't, then, you know, I'll do it in the next lifetime.
Well, speaking of symphonic, let's go backwards. Let's start off with the new record, the 50th anniversary. Gosh, David, can you believe it's 50 years of Renaissance?
No.
Yeah, it's great. Well, look, I remember the first record because I was a Yardbirds fan because of Jim.
Yeah.
So I was a fan from the beginning. And when you went solo as well, you know, being a Move fan and seeing that first album, which is, by the way, still a brilliant and relevant recording. It's a great record.
That was Annie Haslam from her first solo album, Annie in Wonderland. The tune, I Never Believed in Love. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
Wait, you're talking about Annie in Wonderland?
Yes, I am.
Yes. Oh, my God. I tell you something. That was because Roy, you know, I lived with him for 4 years. The guy's a genius.
Sure.
You know, in the minute, we had an 8-foot round waterbed. I'm not going any further than that in a rude way. But this one night, he woke me up. And he was singing in his sleep, and he was singing something. I thought, that sounds like a hit to me. So I spent the next 2 hours trying to get out of the waterbed without disturbing him. And you know, so like every movement, there was a glug, glug, glug. And in the end, of course, in the end, I couldn't do it. I told him. And then from then on, we had a tape recorder by the side of the bed. But genius. I learned so much from him and laughed a lot in those 4 years. I'm amazed that I can still speak after the laughter. But very funny man, you know. Brilliant. Yeah. And it's the album. Wow. Oh, my God. It's every dream, really, for a singer. You know, and the different things like Rockalese, you know, that uses my octaves. And then If I Loved You. And of course, when I did If I Loved You, that's when Paul McCartney was at the studio, Delaney Studios.
Yes, you were. He came and visited you in the studio.
Yeah, he came in. He listened to I just finished my vocal. He was listening outside and came in and sat and talked to us for like an hour or whatever it was. It was brilliant. And he just said, you know, he loved my voice. And that I thought, yeah. And he said it sent shivers up his spine. I thought,
oh, that's wonderful. Wonderful. But it is a great record. I'm going to play a few tracks from it on the radio show so people get a chance to hear it. I love the record. So there you have it.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, no, it's what a great first album, really. It was amazing. Yeah, very exciting.
You started off in fashion. You you studied fashion first, and you were on Savile Row and Carnaby Street. Take us back to the swing in the 60s.
Oh, my God. Well, I used to wear short skirts. I know that. My God. Didn't we all?
Tom.
Yeah, I guess some men did, but most men didn't, you know. It was a fantastic time, really. I mean, my brother Michael was a singer. I didn't know that I was going to be a singer. And I got this, I started off, you know, going to art school for that reason, you know, for to learn how to be a dress designer. That's what I wanted to be. And then ended up in London with a very different job as a freight booking clerk for the Far East for MacGregor Gowan Holland, like a big shipping line company. And it was a job while I was doing that. I was writing letters out and sketches to all these big companies like Jaeger and all the ones that were big. And everybody replied, really. It was fantastic, very nicely. And then I got this letter from this company called Winsmore. And I say that because they broke my heart and they did something that was really bad. And I don't mind telling people about it because it really, I'm amazed I didn't have a heart attack because I was young and I was, you know, I was full of ideas and I went for, I was on trial. I went for, you know, I was going to say an audition. I went there on trial like for an apprentice to be a sketcher rather than a designer. But they took me in there and I was dealing with the woman who was the daughter of the guy who owned the company. It was a family business, I guess. The older man was going on holiday and he came in to see me and he looked at my drawings. He said, oh, I really like you. He's a lovely man. I really like your work. Lovely, lovely drawings. I look forward to seeing you when I get back. So that would have been after, you know, I'd got the job. That's what he was saying, basically. But anyway, he went and then the daughter, she said, we'll give you, they gave me a big pad and they said, just, you know, come whatever, we want to check what your drawing is like, obviously, if it's going to be good enough. So just do whatever you want, draw whatever you want. Well, obviously, I was going to design what was in my head, all these different designs. And at the end of 2 hours, at the end of doing that, I did quite a few. And they came and got the book and took it in their office for 2 hours and then they fired me.
But they stole your designs.
I don't think I got the book back either, thinking about it. And it really, I thought, you horrible. And of course, that threw me right off. I thought, why do I want to go in this kind of business? Oh, and then I got in the music business. Duh. But then again, obviously that was similar in some ways, but yeah, that you get a lot of hard knocks in that as well. But joining Renaissance was like, that was it. Changed my life forever. I was meant to be in that band. And it was all the other things were, you know, they're stepping stones, you know. And I wouldn't change a thing.
That was Renaissance doing Prologue from the album of the same name with our guest, Annie Haslam, on vocals. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
I wouldn't change anything because it all leads to, it's like, if you take one person out of your life, everything changes.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now you joined, you answered an ad in the Melody Maker, like so many people did. We had the Village Voice in New York. You had the Melody Maker.
That's
and
right.
You were part of the Bieber crowd. So, you know, I guess.
I had a Bieber coat. It's still in my wardrobe, but I can't get my arm in it even. It's so small.
Any comment on the synergy between music and fashion? One of the most fascinating passages in George Martin's book, All You Need Is Ears, which he wrote in the 80s, I think it was, yeah, or maybe even the 70s. He talked about how important fashion was in music in the sense that he says people listen to music with their eyes. And he commented on the Beatles and he said, as talented as they were, obviously, they were gorgeous. They were amazing to look at.
Yeah.
And that George Martin, according to George, was that people give you a chance to like them based on the way you look when you walk on stage. So, and you've always been very, very theatrically bent, let's say.
I guess, but not over the top. I was kind of very, very low key. I didn't wear glitter and, you know, I didn't have my boobs hanging out and I didn't wear flowery dresses because that's not who I was. I don't know how people wear stiletto heels and walk down steps. I have no idea. But I sang barefoot. And when I first started out, I didn't wear a bra. I didn't wear any makeup, nothing. That's different now. But there you go. That's what they call AGE, right?
But your audience is related to that. Your audience is related to that.
We're all, you know, we're all growing old together, basically. But I think that these days, you know, it's so important as well. You're talking about fashion. It's really got to be the whole package because something can throw. I went to see Johnny Mathis He's one of my favorite voices ever on this earth. And it was in Atlantic City, and I went with a friend of mine, and he came out on stage, and he had a suit that looked like it was 10 sizes too big. But not only that, it was all wrinkled, like it had just come out of a suitcase.
That was Johnny Mathis, 1957, doing Wonderful, Wonderful. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
It's very different now because people can, they're doing it from home and all kinds of things, but don't care so much about the way they look, which I think is sad. But most people do. And of course, the kids growing up that like them probably wear the same stuff. So I should take that back because everything is so different. You know, of course, I'm older. And when you're older, you look at things like your mum did when she was young.
Yes, we do.
It's like your mother, you know. Well, I'm glad.
I'm 17-year-old. I understand completely.
You are 17 now. Did you say I'm 17?
No. I said I have a 17-year-old daughter.
Oh, do you? Okay. Yeah.
So I'm understanding of all the foibles, let us say, of youth.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, I don't have any children. I don't think I could have done what I did with Renaissance if I had children. That's obviously not my mission in life. I kind of sad in a way, but I think, you know, I would be a little concerned because of the way the world is now. It would have, I would have liked a little mini me, whether it was a boy or a girl, you know, pass on whatever I have, you know. I mean, as far as clothing and things, I started out with the dresses with the long sleeves to the floor, which were very simple. The lady was called Valerie James, and I keep meaning to kind of connect with her again because she was lovely. And those dresses were really quite unique then. I mean, what I wore was unique, simple, you know, wore a little delicate necklace. And I did get some shoes made at Anello and David's, and they were white kid. Of course, I'm vegetarian now and nothing animal, but they were little white ankle boots, white kid. I had them made for me, and I think I only wore them for like one tour. Then I thought I can't move around like I want to, really, and not that I jump around the stage. I want to feel the stage, and I couldn't do it with these shoes on, the boots. And they only had a small Cuban heel. Do you remember that?
Yes.
And so I started going barefoot, and it went on from there. You know, of course, when we did Carnegie Hall, and the music was progressing naturally. It wasn't like we'd go into rehearsals and say, right, well, I think we've got to make this more dramatic now, and you know, to move the band forward. We only did what came to us naturally, and it was like, it was brilliant.
You were listening to Renaissance live at Carnegie Hall, Mother Russia. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
I mean, it was great, my audition, where I met Jim, of course, and Keith Ralph. And it was kind of an odd time because it was a six-piece band and there was a male singer in it then, Terry Crowe. Right. So I was really a backing singer. But it was so exciting. I remember it was either Addlestone or Weybridge in Surrey in a church hall kind of room. And, I got the job. They called me the next day. I just knew when I walked in, I felt it, you know. I felt that it was just right. And I'd never heard of Renaissance. I bought the album after this guy, when at the show, and the Strand, which was my cabaret period, that was short but very exciting. Loved everything about it. The guitarist, he's the one who showed me the ad. He said, Annie, you got to go for this. He said, your voice isn't right. It, you know, it's different. You shouldn't be doing this. But although I was having fun, I was singing like dancing in the street and having a gila with a tambourine with ribbons on it, you know. It was fabulous. It was great. So that was a big stepping stone.
From a musical family. Your brother Michael was actually signed by Brian Epstein.
He was. And he was on the Christmas shows, the Beatles Christmas shows.
Oh, with the Zombies, like, oh, the Mike Cotton Sound, right? With
Moody Blues.
Okay.
I think he was on two of them. I'm not quite sure how many Christmas shows they did.
That was the Beatles doing their Christmas message. This happened every year. If you were a member of the Beatles fan club, you got one of these flexi discs. Let's get back to our conversation with Annie Haslam. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
He's passed away now. His voice was just fabulous. When I was recovering from breast cancer, I went over to England to stay with him, and it rained every day. And I was there for about 2 weeks, and I thought, oh, what am I going to do? And I was getting better. My strength was coming back, you know. But one day I just said, why don't we see if we can record something? And he said, well, I've got a bass amp. I've got the Behr microphone you gave me. And he said, I've got some karaoke tapes, because he wasn't really working so much then. He was just singing in pubs and things, which was sad. Really. But anyway, we decided to record, and we did Somewhere Out There from American Tale. Okay. And I don't know if you've heard it or not, but you can hear it. It's from my album Woman Transcending. I did a released songs that were like, you know, didn't get released or were rare, and that went on there. And our voices together, that's the only thing we've ever recorded together.
That was Somewhere Out There, a tune that both Annie and her brother Michael recorded together, the only thing they ever recorded. Great piece of music, beautifully done. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
His voice was wonderful. My father was an amateur comedian singer and very funny man, and with the voice of a tenor, I would say. But I look back and I think, oh my God, and I said this in a couple of interviews, I wish that I'd been older then and could have helped my father, because he could have been something with his voice. But he was a dad. He didn't think, he just did it as a hobby. And it, you know, he sang things like Jezebel and Frankie Lane songs and Johnny Mathis, Nat King Cole, and you know, and because that's when he did Nature Boy. That's where I got Nature Boy from.
What was it about prog rock and symphonic rock, if you will, that resonated so closely with American audiences? So you look at the bands: Jethro Tull, Genesis, King Crimson, yes, Renaissance among them, the Straubs, Gentle Giant. That music, which was so profoundly British, somehow struck a chord with American audiences.
Well, I'm not saying it's not so much the music, but I think that Americans were captivated with the English accent as well.
Okay.
You know? And before I went for elocution lessons, I used to talk like this, you know. You're right. Can I have a piece of cake? Come on,
my fair lady, huh?
Come on, then, let's have you.
That was The Rain in Spain from the soundtrack to My Fair Lady. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
My mum and dad had the foresight to send me to elocution lessons when I was about 10. And they must have known something was coming up for me, because they couldn't really afford that. They couldn't, you know, but they sent me for elocution lessons.
Your singing teacher, Sybil Knight, she's the one that discovered that you had a 5-octave range.
She's the one who brought it out in me, because, yeah, okay. The exercise. I wish, though, you know, when you're growing up, you're changing every day. This was like, when was it, 68, around that time, 69, whatever. And so I didn't think, I thought, when I realized I could sing, I thought, oh, this is great. I didn't think that I should learn an instrument or learn how to write or read music, which was a shame, because the number of times that if I learned to play a guitar, even though Roy bought me one, he bought me one when we split up. He bought me an acoustic guitar, because so many people have said, can you just come on your own and do an interview and play a guitar, you know? I said, well, I haven't got a guitar. Well, you know, I can't play the guitar. So I think I wish I'd learned to read music. And she wanted me to go into opera, because she said, your voice is different, has a different sound, and you have the octaves. And I just didn't want to, you know, do something where I'd be stuck in one place for months on end. That didn't appeal to me at all, even though I had no idea where I was going. And it was Harold Miller who taught Shirley Bassey, was the one who put me in touch with her, because he couldn't take me on because he only taught in the daytimes. And he said the same thing. He said, your voice is different. It's got something different to it. And he said, I really would like to work with you, but I had a day job. So that's why I went to Sybil Knight.
That was from a Genesis tribute record. This tune was called Ripples, and it featured our guest, Annie Haslam. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
When you were studying with her, were there any arias that she introduced you to that really stuck?
No, not really. It was a lot of exercising. And I mean, my memory is so full of so much stuff that I just can't get to a lot of it, you know. But I found something the other day, and it's a piece of paper with her writing on it. And it was called Vakai. And it's some kind of a piece that we did where I exercised. And I've got it. I found it the other day. And it's in like immaculate condition, this piece of music that she wrote out. Not for me to read, but the words were on it. I just remember mainly, she probably did, but I had a love for not particularly opera at that time, but classical music, yes. The guy who really started me off, my boyfriend at the time, Eric Peacock, he's the one who really saw that I could sing when I got drunk at parties, and he'd say, I think we're going to have to put him for, you know, your brother Michael can sing, you know, so you're going to... We're going to put you in for some talent competitions. My God, I was winning them. And I remember that I went down, I remember this pub in the East End of London. It was a bit, I think it was like a Cray Brothers haunt. Remember the Cray Brothers?
Yeah, I do.
Michael played in pubs where they come in, you know, and everything. I mean, heavy stuff there, but a real old English pub with like stained glass windows and glass and everything everywhere. And it really smelt of beer when you went in, and cigarettes. And I remember wearing this short dress, and it was kind of it was a mini dress, absolutely. And then, and I had white underwear underneath, and I didn't realize they'd got ultraviolet lights over the stage. So the men were all crowding around the front. You know, yeah, you know, they really like me, but they really like my bra and knickers. That's what they like. That was so funny. That was very interesting, but he was the one, really, the catalyst of it all.
That was Renaissance doing Northern Lights. They had a top 10 hit with that in the UK. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
Now, did you have any favorite vocalists that you were... enjoying at the same time?
Absolutely. Joan Baez, who I got to meet. It was just before I was going in for chemo and radiation. I had them both at the same time for breast cancer. And she was playing. My hair was short. I'd cut it short because I knew I was going to lose it. And Ed Sharkey, I went with to see her at the Electric Factory in Philadelphia. And got to go backstage. I took some flowers, and I was speechless. And she knew who I was. And we had a wonderful picture. I've got this fabulous picture. It's on my Facebook page somewhere of us together. And, of course, and I listened to Joni Mitchell as well. Oh, gosh. They were the two. Really. Uh-huh. And classical music. And I used to like, different kind of music altogether. I used to like Hughie Ledbetter. And I got a great album of his called, you know, Lead Belly, and right. And Jack Teagarden and people like that, and then Jimmy Reed. I can't remember, but John Lee Hooker. I went to see John Lee Hooker perform in Plymouth. That's when I was living in Cornwall. Gosh, I used to love that, and we used to play all that kind of stuff at the art school that I went to in Redruth. We played all that kind of music. So different kind of. I've forgotten all about that. I've not said anything like that recently, but yeah, all kinds of music. If it's good music, that's great. I don't understand rap music at all. I can't get it. I've tried. I can't. It's not who I. It's not my.
How about Sandy Denny and folks in the.
Oh, gosh, of course, Sandy. Yeah, Sandy and Fairport Convention opened for us at the Academy of Music in 1974 in New York. They opened up for us. We did that. It was the first time we played with an orchestra. Wow. And I think that's when Howard Stein, who was the promoter, came on stage and played piano with John Tout before we did the show, before we did the main show. Or was it in the break in the middle? But I do remember at the end of the show, millions of rose petals came down on everybody in the theatre. I'll never forget that as long as I live. Wow. But Sandy, oh my God, what a beautiful woman, and inside and out, you know, but she and very gifted, because I found that during my career, most women didn't want to speak to me. They're very competitive. I'm not going to name names, but you'll be surprised. You know, what horrible. Why can't you just say, well, I love your voice, you know? That's all I wanted to say, but no, you can't even come and say that, or, you know, I get a handshake that's like a wet fish kind of thing. Sandy was the only one, really, that was just, you know, just a real person. And I was asked in 2019, I get this phone call from Ray, who runs the Strand Theatre in Lakewood, New Jersey, and he said, oh, Annie, Dave Cousins wants to talk to you about being part of their 50th anniversary weekend. And they want you to sing Who Knows Where the Time Goes with a 35-piece orchestra. Oh, I couldn't believe it.
Now, that was Sandy Denny with the Straubs doing Who Knows Where the Time Goes, 1967. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
Isn't that amazing? And so Tony Visconti did an arrangement for it. He conducted that. And then I also did Reaching Out from the Intergalactic Touring Band. That was Dave Cousins was on that album. And he said the track that his favorite track was the one I did, Reaching Out. Right. So we did that with the orchestra. And then I sang three songs with the Acoustic Straubs over that weekend. A couple of weeks before, I get this amazing call from Ray. And then, of course, I spoke to Dave later on that day. Something very interesting happened in my garden. Since I started painting, unbelievable things have happened to me spiritually and can't explain things going on. So I go outside and I've got my iPhone. I think I just put the phone down and from somebody. And it was on the ledge outside, and I was looking very quietly, and there was a fox on the tree stump that was about 25 feet away, I would say, 20 feet away from me, 30 maximum. And to the left of that was a big holly tree, but there was a fox sitting on the stump and it was raised up, and so it was like leaning on the stump and eating something or whatever. So I thought, get my phone quick. So I got my phone, but just before I got my phone, to the left of the fox, it must have been about 10 foot tall, maybe bigger. It was like this swirling mass of smoke or steam or whatever. It wasn't smoke. There was no smell of smoke, but it was all this wispy, like gossamer, just absolutely beautiful. And I got my phone quick and I was like, I'm looking at it. And I got it just as it dissipated. I've got this little bit of, and it looks like you can see a face in it. But then I got that phone call 2 weeks later, or it could have been a week later. And I immediately thought, I think that was Sandy in my garden. I know everybody's going, get away with it, you know. Go and play down your own end, as they say. But that happened, you know?
Well, we did an interview with Richard Thompson a few weeks back, and I related this story. I went to the Bitter End one night to see Sandy. It was in February. It was the coldest night of the year. No one was in the audience but myself and two friends. She did her full show and then came out and sat with us. And she was one of the loveliest people I've ever met. So she's sitting now, she's chatting with us, and she says, have you guys heard of Monty Python?
Oh.
You know, it hadn't been on PBS yet, so of course me, I'm going, no, what kind of music do they do? And then fast forward a million years, John Alton and I became friends. John wrote that tune,
Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. That's his arrangement.
Oh, yeah. Really? Wow.
Yeah. Eric Idle came in with a guitar, just an acoustic guitar demo, and said to John, what can you do with this? And it's become the most popular song in the world. And played at funerals.
On the bright side of life. Can I tell you a quick Eric Idle story?
Of course. Absolutely.
So it was, let's see, what year was it? It was when Paul McCartney was, he'd been arrested in Japan.
1980 then, right? 79, 80?
So you must have been probably 79, because we went, Michael Dunford and I went up to Warner Brothers offices in London. And I think we'd gone out to dinner with a managing director who was a really great guy. And then we came back to the office to get some champagne or whatever. And then in comes, it's after hours, Eric Idle comes in and Chrissy Hynde come into the office. And so I think we were having a drink, you know, I can't remember all the details. I wish Mickey was alive, because he probably remember, you know, but it was ridiculously funny, of course. So Eric says, I think we should call up the Japanese embassy and try and get Paul out, Chris, whatever he was, because we were all drunk, you know. And he's like, hey, yeah, I'm calling these people up. And oh my God, it was so hilarious. And then I went to see him at the Tower Theatre with my ex-husband, and he was hilarious, of course. And met him afterwards, and brought up, brought it up. And I don't know if he really remembered, because he was out of his head. You know, we all were. But he did put something on his Facebook or somewhere, and he said, "I met a very nice young lady yesterday called Anne." Which was me, and he said, "I think we did. There was something we met. You know, whatever it was, it was funny." But I'll never forget. Just I can see us all in that office drinking away, you know. And he said, "I think we should call up the Japanese embassy." We couldn't stop laughing, so he did. You know, what a great guy, though. What, how funny. Oh, gosh. But, yeah, that song's amazing, isn't it? And what a way to look at things. Look, you've got to look on the bright side of life, especially now. It's even harder, you know, but you're going to do it. You can't give up. You've got to keep going forward.
When we look at your career with Renaissance and, of course, even your solo career, we're talking about the album era. And for some of our younger viewers who don't know what an album is, I have one right here. I don't know if you remember that one.
Yes.
That's a record album. David, look at this.
They're John and Mickey are wearing my jackets. They're both my
jackets. Oh, those are jackets, all right. Yes, they are. I wore something similar to that when I was playing with John Parr, and my mom said, "Oh, my God, you can't wear that again."
Well, let me ask you, Annie, in an age of streaming and Spotify and playlists and algorithms and YouTube and Instagram, is the album format, as you are just presenting here with the latest Renaissance Live album, is that still relevant nowadays? You think it is?
I don't know if it is, to be honest. Of course, there were a lot of concept albums, weren't there? Not many people are doing that now, except for us heritage. I hate to say the heritage. Well, it's true. Heritage bands. But a lot of people are just doing singles and putting them out on iTunes, aren't they? And just streaming things. It's so I don't understand a lot of it. I remember I spoke to somebody at Warner Brothers about royalties that haven't been paid still. I don't think he's there anymore. This was a few years ago now. And he said, and I'm amazed I got through to somebody to speak to, because as an artist, you rarely get through. Oh, yeah, you might have different phone numbers and things, whatever. But I didn't want to bring a lawyer into it, because you got to pay them. So I did speak to this guy, and he said, "Annie, I'll do my best to look into it for you." But he said, there's so many artists on Warner Brothers, of course, the same situation. And now people are doing all these digital downloads and all this kind of thing. And he said, it's an absolute mess. And nobody really knows how to deal with it.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of people like us that could really do well if we could get that money to survive that is owed to us. But the you know, chances of that really are very slim, you know, to put things out like in solo songs, like, you know, my friend Jan Close, we did a cover version of Don't Give Up. He's like, his voice, he's got the whole package. He's a great songwriter himself, you know, looks great. And he's got the drive and personality. He's got the whole package, you know. And what he does, what he has been doing, he's working on an album now, but he's mainly been doing just one-off singles and doing it like that, getting in the iTunes charts. And, you know, I don't understand all of it. I mean, there's so many avenues where your music is. I would say it's waning. It's not raining, it's waning. But I can't give you any better answer than that. Because I don't understand a lot of what's going on. I only know that there's so many places to place your music now. You can record from home, and you can make an album at home if you wanted to.
You can make an album on your phone, yeah.
Yeah. And there's, of course, most people download things. And the physical, you know, after the 50th anniversary one we just did, we might not do anything else like physical like that, even though, you know, a lot of fans our age want that.
That was Ashes Are Burning from the 50th anniversary Renaissance album of the same name. It's a live record featuring Jim McCarty on drums on that track. Jim was the original drummer for the Yardbirds. He's still playing with the Yardbirds, and he was also in Renaissance. This is Notes from an Artist, CygnusRadio.com.
Talk about inviting Jim McCarty back as a special guest.
Yeah, that came full circle, didn't it? My gosh. Well, I've been in touch with Jim. I went to see him in New York at the Iridium.
Oh, yes, with the Yardbirds?
Jan was opening up for him, I think, there as well. And who else was there? It wasn't the Yardbirds. It was just Jim, you know, okay. Jim on his own with his band. They were fabulous. That was the last time I'd seen him since 6 years ago, something like that. I said to Rave, Rave is my other half in the band now. He's wonderful, the keyboard player, and right. He's a very clever man, and he helps a great deal. And I said to him, I said, you know, we really need to make this special. And I thought, well, I still want to put my paintings up, but use different paintings because they're different songs, you know. Mm-hmm. And then I said, I think I'm going to see if Jim McCarty will come over. And I thought, oh my God, what a perfect idea. So I contacted him and he immediately said yes. He came over. I think he did a couple of shows as well while he was here before our show down south in a little club or something. But he was here and he did a great job. Everybody loved him to bits because he's such a beautiful spirit. His personality is fabulous, you know. And I've got some great little videos. I want to put the disc or whatever, download or whatever, at some point of that tour. I wanted to do it for the actual package, but I it was amazing that I could even get through that. And Rave didn't start mixing until the following September after the October because of the pandemic. We didn't feel right to do anything productive or artistic. So yes, I was very happy that it came out. Cherry Red Records in England, Mark Powell in particular, is always been a great friend to the band, and they put out over the last year the major albums, Renaissance albums. They bought the catalogue up from Warner Brothers and they put in box sets, if anybody's interested in that. Some people don't know. And the box set, the box itself was fabulous. And I thought, we've got to try and get this for the 50th anniversary. I like it. Because before we used this kind of long one and it needed to be different. So I contacted Mark and they got their boxes from somewhere over in Europe. And so they helped put it all together for me. And that was wonderful. It changed everything. Yeah, so all the albums are out and they've got booklets and great. And that's why we've got that lovely box, the set, you know, and it's really, really substantial, isn't it? You could like throw it out into the street and it probably wouldn't mark at all. God knows what it's made from, you know. You know what I mean? It was fab. So that was, I'm very proud of it. I'm really happy that Jim got to be on it. So thrilled. I think we did it. I never thought when I was when you're younger, you don't even think that far ahead. What am I going to be doing like in my 70s? You know, you just don't think about it.
Well, great stuff. Thanks for talking with us. And we're going to play tracks from all your records.
We're going to do a track on the Major Galactic album.
Oh, gosh, what a great album.
Got that when it first came out. But you know why I got it? Tom probably too. It had Percy Jones on fretless.
Yes. You've got quite a resume of bass players.
Percy Jones.
I thought you said Pussy Jones.
That's what we call him.
Oh, my God.
No, that's my old girlfriend.
Oh. And how about the recording you did with John Wetton? That was, you worked with John. Wasn't he? Yeah, he was in Renaissance for a few shows, wasn't he?
He was in the four shows with us. Did one of the big ones was the Reading Festival, of course, and then he moved on to Uriah Heep was his next one, I think, and then Asia King Crimson as well. He was in.
Sure. Yeah.
Must have been after. Yeah, I've been fortunate, very fortunate. You know, I've worked with Steve Howe. We did write. I went to England after we put on a show, a benefit show called Lilies in the Field for the orphans in Sarajevo. And that was a big thing in 1997, I think it was. And then I got to know Steve Howe more. And then I went to England and we started writing together. And we wrote a few songs together. But he got a phone call when I was there from John Anderson asking him to get Yes back together again. So you can't put 100% into everything, you know.
Yeah.
So we did some lovely, lovely things together and incredible. And then I also got to be on something with Steve Hackett recently, which was really exciting because somebody else I've wanted my voice to be with his guitar, you know. And it's a guy called David Manassian. I don't know if you've heard about that. It's an album called Sound of Dreams.
I'll look that one up.
Justin Hayward's on there as well, and Billy Sherwood. I wrote this song, the lyrics to the song called Sound of Dreams, and that's the one with Steve Hackett and Billy on as well. It's phenomenal. You have to listen to it.
We will.
It's on YouTube. The one to listen to is the one that's the remix, and it's the first one wasn't mixed very well. It's a remix. David Manassian's Sound of Dreams, and it's when my voice comes in with the guitar, it's just amazing. She said modestly.
That was the Sound of Dreams. Annie Haslam on vocals, Steve Hackett on guitar. This is Notes from an Artist. CygnusRadio.com.
Remember what Shakespeare said: those who do not tooteth their own horneth, their horneth remaineth untooteth.
Did you say toot?
Tooteth.
Oh, because I know toot means something else.
Oh, no. Not for years.
Yes, that'll be the next interview. All right, Annie, great. Thanks for talking with us. Okay. We'll catch up with you, and we'll tell Billy when all this airs, and we'll send you the links, okay?
Okay, lovely. Thank you so much. Give back. Can you give my Facebook page
We'll be on it. Absolutely. We'll copy something.
All right. Thanks, David.
Well, that's our show for tonight. I want to thank my co-host, Tom Semioli, and of course, Annie Haslam for a sparkling interview. Don't forget to check out their new record, the new Renaissance recording, Ashes Are Burning, the 50th anniversary. I also want to let you know we are now being sponsored by DR Strings. And I also want to let you know that we are archiving all of our shows via our podcast, Notes from an Artist. You can find that on all major podcast players or at notesfromanartist.buzzsprout.com. So this is David Gross with my co-host Tom Semioli, thanking you for listening, and have a great week. See you next week.